Good evening. Good evening and welcome back to the Edgy Futurist podcast. Steve, how are you, sir?
I'm loving. I'm gonna give the game away. So, second episode of season three.
Yep.
With the duo, me and Ben. And last one with John Neil was absolutely outstanding. Absolutely loved it. Excited for this one tonight. We've been chatting for an overrunning with our chats about football and lots of different things to somebody I've just met and somebody that Ben knows well. But we didn't have the intro. It was edited in.
I'm giving it away.
But you know what? It's the first time I've sat listening there and I was like, that is absolutely exceptional. Well done, Ben. I loved it. Love the intro. Great design work and loving the new song choice. So great way to kick off season three. I'm giving it away. I'm giving the game away.
I can't believe you've given that secret away already, man. That's like, we're pros. Nobody would have ever known like that we edited
that. We are pros, but in fairness, there's nothing pro about me. You've done the design. You've done the music. I just waffle and everything else. But no, it's been a good week, yeah, man. I think. It's Thursday. We're back to this is the first Thursday night we've done for a bit.
Yeah,
and now I'm excited. They're coming thick and fast. We've got about 10 that we've got lined up, Ben? We're running in now where we're just like, we're searching for guests. We've got another brilliant one out to follow on from John Neil. We've got a couple to follow on. And we've also got dropped one in from just me and Ben, just talking about our journey of restarting the podcast in 2024 and everything else. But how's your week been, Ben? How's life, mate?
Yeah, this week's been, it's been epic, really. Got some good a lot of content creation this week, which has been right on my street, working with some pals, but also working with some businesses and some education places. I'm off to Newcastle in the morning, not seeing Dan. He's flown out to America, but I'm going up there to speak at a conference, which is pretty cool. But I did have a little bit of a moment tonight while we were just having our tea with the kids. We always have some music on in the background, and I said to Amanda, my wife, I said, are you going to pick the songs for today? And she went, I tell you what we'll do. We'll listen to a Now That's What I Call Music album. Now, I don't know if these are global things, so if you're listening outside of the UK, apologies, but Now That's What I Call Music have been like iconic compilation albums over many, many years. And now she said, let's listen to, and then picked a random number, Now 40. Now 40. I'm going to put a link in this to the show notes, but Now 40 has got some absolute bangers on it from 1998. My kids weren't alive. My kids didn't understand it, but like Teardrop by Massive Attack, Sonnet by The Verve, Come Back to What You Know by Embrace, Rockefeller Skank by Fatboy Slim, Horny by Moose T. Nothing wrong with that, is there? A little bit of Horny by Moose T.
Just on that one, what's some bangers?
Save Tonight, remember, by Eagle Eye Cherry.
One of my favourite songs of all time. Save Tonight by Eagle Eye Cherry. awesome video, by the way.
Yeah,
awesome video. So. Teardrop by Massive Attack. Awesome video.
Yeah.
But remember when we were, we met in Leeds. And we were discussing the podcast during some challenging times that everybody now calls the COVID years. And we were talking about, we said, we think we need to make a decision. I think this is not a temporary shutdown. I think this will become a global event and we need to maybe switch to an online event. But the reason we've met in Leeds is not just to discuss face-to-face how we're going to go online for our event, but we went to see Star Sailor and Embrace, didn't we?
We did. Embrace. Yeah, one of my favorite.
And it was the last, I believe it was the last conference, the last concert in the UK before COVID shut down.
It was indeed. We were at the last concert in Leeds watching Embrace and Star Sailor. Yeah, I knew that you'd remember that. That's the reason why
I love Embrace, massive Embrace fan. But no, it sounds like a good week.
Yeah,
what
very,
a great
very good.
Way. You know, our focus and everything else is work and everything else, but lovely to just sit down with the family and just think about mum and dad's music, and but also how that transcends. And did the kids like it? Did they get it?
Well, the first song that comes on was the Grease Megamix. Now, well, that and then a bit of Spice Girls. So the kids knew them ones, but when I was starting rocking out some of these classics, they were a bit like, "Dad, this music is rubbish."
Yeah. They were like, "I don't think this could be a BTS cover." No. Don't think this is going to be K-pop overtaken.
Swifty won't be doing this one, I don't think.
Maybe. Well, she only makes her own, doesn't she?
Yeah.
So, but yeah, my week's been good. Another family moment. My little boy turned two, so I took the day off and we spent the day as a family. It also coincided with my little girl wearing her school uniform for the first time. It was Ella's first nursery step into the school that she's going to be in for reception.
Love it.
In September, a lovely state school, primary school. Really, it was just really nice to chat to the teachers. And I got to have the first conversation. My boy loved his birthday. He's a boy. He just runs around, pushes kicks, plays football. He's already signed up. And I've told him if he don't make it into a professional Premier League tie by seven, I'm going to pull him out because he's never going to make it. But, you know, we have them challenges in a two-year-old conversation. But my little girl, I said, what was your favourite part of your day today? What have you most enjoyed? And she said, I've made some really good friends today, Daddy. So I was like, that's a bit for me. Do you know, people talk about, Ofsted and written. I was like, if she's making friends, she's happy. That is the focus. So sure. we've talked for about 20 minutes so far, Ben, in terms of our week. Should we get a guest on, do you think?
I think we should. So we are massively pleased to be joined by my brother from another mother. Like, we have that kinship now, don't we? This is SA2 Stofile from all the way from South Africa. I'll let him tell a little bit of his story, but he's not... He's a good, good man. And I'm very, very excited for tonight's episode with... brother is the right word. So, SA2, give us a little bit of an insight into you, my friend. Welcome to the podcast.
My brother. Thank you so much, Ben. Thank you so much, Ben and Steve. So, I'm SA2 Stofile. So, whenever someone asks me, where are you from? I always try and figure out, are you trying to establish where I stay right now or where I'm originally from? So where I'm from is a small village out there in the Eastern Cape in South Africa called Lusikisiki. So Lusikisiki is predominantly Mpondoland, and I'll explain to you what Mpondoland is. So that is where originally I am from, even though I was personally born in Alice, which is still in the Eastern Cape, but probably about 8 hours away from Lusikisiki. So I was born of five kids. I'm the only son, second born. So I've had the privilege of being surrounded by ladies all my life, and grew up that side. When I finished my grade 12 in East London, then I moved to Cape Town, of which I spent about 22 years. Of my life. And that 22 years consist of, you know, higher education studies, that side. And also then I started working that side, where started my career as a... In fact, this is what you don't know about me, Ben. I started working as a pathologist. So I used to cut up dead bodies, and
that explains a lot.
Boom, boom, boom. I thought, let me just drop something in there for you. So I was working at one of the local clinics as a pathologist whilst I was still pursuing my honours degree. And then I realised that, you know what, I didn't have a sufficient salary, nor could I study further, because these two were conflicting. So then I decided then to take on a teaching job, because at least then you are able to teach up until about 3 p.m., and then I can study thereafter. So then I started teaching, supposed to teach science, but there was no science posts. So they chucked me in mathematics. And then I started teaching mathematics. And it was supposed to be for about 3 months, because then they said that maybe there will be a post, because someone was supposed to leave, but the person didn't leave. I was stuck in a mathematics post. And I grew to love mathematics, and completed my studies in 2019, focusing on mathematics. But then I transitioned from being a maths teacher to being the head of mathematics at the school, moved from one school to another one. It was a high school. Then I was in the advanced mathematics program. From the advanced maths program, then I was part of doing Olympiads right across the Western Cape. And then I had an opportunity to go to Norway. So then I went to Norway in Bergen. I don't know if I'm saying it correctly. I don't want to butcher it. But it's literally not too far from Kristiansand and Oslo, because I used to commute by train. But I spent some time in Bergen, where I did some of my studies and my research at that side. But I was still a teacher in Cape Town. So then that's where technology came into my world, because now I needed to compensate for the fact that I'm not in South Africa. I'm doing something for my own personal development, but I still needed to add value in my teaching community. So had a stint of, you know, staying in Bergen, came back to South Africa. Then I became an e-learning advisor at a district, and then spent about 3 years as an e-learning advisor. Then I became the head of special projects for the whole of the Western Cape. So all the schools in the Western Cape, I had to look after all new projects when it comes to innovation, whether it's coding and robotics, learning management systems, virtual schooling, 3D printing. I mean, if it had something to do with the 21st century, it was just chucked onto Esetu's plate. And then I found my way through that. I navigated through the bureaucratic lines. And then fortunately, I found a placement at Cloud Edu, where I am now a Google Workspace Transformation Specialist. So, and I deal with the HEIs right across Africa. And with that short introduction, I am Mpondo. Mpondo is one of the tribes here in South Africa. And when I said to you earlier on, I come from a predominantly Mpondo area. That's where all of the Mpondos, they usually stay in the same area, and we can track back to probably about 15 generations to the original person who was called, his first name was Mpondo. And therefore, he had sons who were in the monarchy. So then all of his firstborn kids, or maybe secondborn, if the first one had passed away, they became kings. And then through that kingship, that's when my family then, which is the Stofile family, comes from. And then the establishment of Stofile was in Lusikisiki with all the other Mpondos. But he was a preacher. So he moved away from Lusikisiki, then he went over to, because we can divide the Eastern Cape into two major parts, which is the Siskei and the Transkei. There's a Kei River. So if you're on this side of the Kei River, you are in the Siskei. But if you go over the Kei River, then you're in the Transkei. So Lusikisiki is more in the Transkei area, closer to Durban. So he left, he went to Siskei, and that's where my lineage, which is the rest of the Stofile family, then resided. And then I recently got reconnected with the Lusikisiki community last year, where I had lost my father, lost some of my uncles, and then they said, listen, you belong here. This is where your land is. This is where your people. This is your responsibility, because now you are the last one who carries the Stofile family, and therefore it is your obligation now to take on these duties. So, in a nutshell, hi.
I told you, Steve. I told you there was a million things in this. Like, I didn't even know about pathologists. I didn't know about. I know a good chunk of that, but yeah, brilliant. It's so good to meet you, man. It's good to hear like this story, and for Steve to hear it for the first time, like it's powerful.
It's an interesting one. We were chatting about backstage, weren't we? Some of that stuff is. So the last thing you mentioned in terms of the tribe and everything else is not through choice. So yeah. Potentially you do have a choice to reconnect and everything else. Of course you do, but it's something that you're born into, something that you're responsible for and everything else. But the thing that resonated with me in terms of your career journey and your path was about excitement, about passion, sure, and about choices, but positive choices. So when you said, well, ultimately, anything that sat in the 21st century, it kind of was passed to me.
Yeah.
But I would probably say that if I was to go back and speak to those people who passed on those projects to you, why did you pass them on? Was it because they were just 21st century and you didn't want them? Or you saw something in the individual that we're now interviewing on the podcast, that yes person, that person that can take it, embrace it, and do something exceptional with? And I've only known you for, since we started chatting, probably about 25 past six, and I see it. So I think that's exciting. And I think that passion comes out even in just your introduction. So the passion has led you there. But yeah, can you be passionate as a pathologist? I suppose it's the starting point. Is it passionate about cutting dead bodies up? I'm not really sure. Should we start there?
I think you know, Steve. One thing that you know drew me first to the field is that I wanted to become a medical doctor. And that was because it sounded like an exciting profession. I mean, my mother was a teacher. My father was a motor mechanic, so he had his own garage where he used to fix cars, maintain cars for government, and so on and so on. So I wanted to do something different. I wanted to do, you know, a career where I could actually help my family out financially. And, you know, being a doctor is like, you know, the job that can actually give you that compensation. So when I moved from East London then to Cape Town, the first degree that I had done was a computer science degree. So I did a BSc in computer science. And then, but, you know, computer science wasn't necessarily where I thought I would end up landing. I just thought, you know, it was just such a cool field because my friends had applied. And I didn't get into medicine purely because the medical school was only offering medicine in Afrikaans. And I don't speak a word of Afrikaans, so I couldn't qualify to get into medicine. So I did a computer science course. And then upon my third year, then I decided to take on, because then as you grow higher, then your modules start to shrink. You take some of the electives fall away, then you're just stuck with your core modules. Then I decided to take some electives from medical bioscience. So whilst I was doing computer science third year, then I was doing medical bioscience first year. And in that pursuit, and I was at a technical school in high school, so there was no biology offered at school. So it was a nice challenge for me because now I'm learning life sciences biology for the first time at university. So then I took the journey on, and shock, it was so exciting. And I don't know whether I was a little bit psychotic as well, because I literally felt like I could dissociate myself away from the human form, and I could just look at the atomic particles, and then I just saw organs. And then it was easier then for me to relate and to see there is a problem, and therefore let's know how to go and find the resolution, which is partly what my dad used to do for cars, but I was just doing it with human beings. So I never really saw it as an icky space. I just saw it as this is interesting.
Yeah. Sorry, Ben, I'm gonna carry a very different line and a very different question. You'll find that we'll go into a rabbit hole and then I'll pick up a random thing. But cool. The thing that also resonated in terms of your story is something that probably your parents, maybe my parents and maybe your parents and our grandparents before that, what used to happen is you went to education, you went to school, a careers person said, I think this is based on, this is what you're probably going to be best at. Somebody then, what you then did is you left work and went into the job, your career, the thing that you're going to do for life. And I think the thing that really just also stood out about the story is about embracing change and going through that process. But also for those people listening that are in education, we have to be honest and we have to keep saying it over and over again, but what we're preparing students for and what we're trying to explain to students of now and probably over the last period of time as well is we're not preparing students for a career. We're preparing individuals for the future of work, and that might be 1,000 different jobs that they might even be doing 5 different jobs at once. Look at Ben's profession. Look at my journey in terms of the different roles that I've played. You know, I've just turned 40, and Ben's turning 40 this year, and we've already done so many different roles, and we've still got 25 years technically in terms of our working life. I think that whole thing of leaving education and finding one career would have meant that you would have been a doctor or stayed as a pathologist, and that's it. You don't want to explore anything else because that's what you've trained to do, and that's where you stay. So what made you want to try different things? Was that something that was inspired to you through your education to move and want to think, I'm not sure this is for me anymore, I want to do something different? Was that the education system, somebody that helped you? What made you think that?
So now I'm going to go back to the beginning. So so I was born in Alice. And in Alice, I lived in a rural community, in a rural village. So I grew up there. And there's only black people that speak Xhosa. So I grew up thinking that the whole world was full of Xhosa people, because I've never seen anyone who's not Xhosa, who's not Black. So growing up in that community, that's all I knew. And I was very good academically when I was still in those lower grades. Then my parents decided to take me out from a Xhosa school, and they took me to a multiracial school, because now they could afford to take me and give me an education whereby I was going to be instructed in English. So, and this is 1993, saw a white person for the first time, who so happened to be my teacher. Now I'm sitting in a classroom with a white teacher with some white students around me and some Black ones, and I have no idea what the teacher is saying. So I'm sitting in a classroom. She's busy trying to give me an instruction, or she's busy trying to give a lesson, and I don't even know what she's talking about. So I failed everything except for mathematics, because at least with mathematics, I saw numbers and I knew exactly what the operations meant. So now that on its own, and unfortunately at the time, my family was very big in, when it came to politics. So Nelson Mandela, Chris Hani were very close with my uncles and my father. So at the time of apartheid, my father and his, because my father is one of seven boys, so all of them were then instrumental in the armed struggle, which meant that they would pick up arms and defend Mkhonto we Sizwe, defend the legacy of ANC. So I grew up then knowing that they are politically involved and they protecting Chris Hani and Nelson Mandela in different instances. And because Chris Hani used to stay at our place. But that cost my father then a couple of years that he was taken into jail. And when he was arrested, I was expelled from school because now of it was called a political exclusion. Now, I think that was a saving grace because it happened just after term one when I had literally flunked everything except for maths. And now I'm being expelled from school. Then I had to stay with this lady, a white lady in a near town. So now I had to stay with her for a couple of months. Now there's a language barrier. I don't understand English. She doesn't understand Xhosa. So that journey created the need for me to understand that I'm not the only one who's going through this experience. So living with her, having her mentor me, tutor me, I found some form of satisfaction in the transition from not knowing to at least thinking that I know, to a point whereby I could actually have a conversation with someone. When I then did my university degrees, computer science then was just a, even though I wanted to do medicine, medicine was just going to be for me, and I just wanted to work in the health sector. Computer science, it was just not something that I wanted to do. I was just doing it for, you know, the influence that my friends had at the time, because, you know, everyone was just trying to get into this field. Teaching became the most satisfying option, purely because it became less about me and it became more about us. Because now I remembered where I came from, and I asked how many of me's still come from those type of environments that will never have the type of family structure that I had, who had the opportunity of letting me stay with this lady in King Williamstown and had this opportunity. So I saw then that, you know, even though it wasn't as financially rewarding as medicine, I'm still going to be a doctor, but I'm not going to be a medical doctor. I'll be a doctor of mathematics. So then my journey then in trying to figure out what do I want to do for the rest of my life, it became less about the title and it was more about the purpose. And my purpose then was to add value. And my name is Esetu Isipho. And to translate that, it is our gift. And therefore, I always wanted to just become a gift. Wherever I am placed, I need to add some form of value. And teaching or education, it literally just was the one field that literally made sense to what I can offer to the world.
This is... is as you listen to this, and if you're not listening to this and thinking to yourself, wow, there's a big background in this story. There's not just I want to be a gift to the world through teaching. And I genuinely believe you are. I think you're one of those people that needs exposure, because if people saw you and what you bring to the world, I've watched when you've delivered training to people and people just gone like that, you're in the palm of your hand, like people going out for breaks and there's food and there's drinks and they don't want to leave the room because they want to be where you are, because what you're offering in that space. You taught me some stuff around differentiation in maths and like stuff that I have never even seen before, and you brought it to life, and you absolutely are a gift. And I think more and more people that get to see that and see you and experience you will know that. I genuinely believe that. I'm not just saying that because you're on a podcast. You know that I think that anyway.
Absolutely.
And I think there's that for me, there's a powerful story in here. John Neal, who was our guest last week on a podcast, said that the skill that he believes that young people will need the most in 2040, or a key skill for 2040, is going to be storytelling and the ability to tell stories. You tell us a perfect story of struggle. You tell us a perfect story of what it means to acknowledge difference and that be okay, but not if that becomes a barrier. And I think that's what I love hearing when I hear you speak. You talk about I'm going to get you to that word in a minute. So get your mouth ready for doing that phrase that you do. You know that phrase that you do. You know what I'm going to get you to do. The one where you say all them noises that nobody, nobody unless you speak your language gets it. It's that process of who you are as a story. It becomes powerful because you're saying, you say it like it's nothing, that your father was what was connected to Nelson Mandela and that broader struggle there for South Africa, and you just got you got expelled from school because he was involved in that. It was just like, yeah, the right to go to school was taken away from you because people were trying to fight for something. And for those of us who have never experienced that, we'll never understand what that means. But just maybe just take us back to that. You said that you thought that was a blessing in disguise because you meant you had to go to another school. Yes, somebody else. Take us back to that, like the struggle, and because I know that struggle. The reason why I'm bringing that is because I know that struggle isn't just 1994 and it's finished. That solved it. So yeah, maybe take us back and tell us a little bit about the struggle, if that's okay.
Sure. So there's this day. I was actually chatting to my mother now because I went back home over the holidays. This day probably traumatized me for the longest of time. And I think I might have been probably 12, either 11 or 12 years old. And I'm sitting at my grandmother's house in the rural village just outside of Alice. And I am with my uncle and my grandfather. And we just get police, or rather soldiers, rushing into the house. So they drove into the yard and then they just came in and they were rushing with guns. And I'm a little boy and I'm not sure what's going on. They strangle my grandfather and they strangle my uncle. They bang them against the walls. They're looking for Chris Hani. And then my uncle and my grandfather said, no, we don't know where he is. And then they get roughed up a little bit. And when I looked at that scene, I was so scared. I was so scared because I didn't know what they had done wrong, but they are getting beaten up. Then the soldiers had left. My father came, I think, a day later when he heard about this incident. And when he came, now he became a little bit upset. And then he was a rough person because of, you know, how he grew up himself. So he decided then to go to the police station and he decided to go and make havoc. So he went there with his staff and he went to ask who hit my father, started hitting people around. They took him into custody. growing up in that village and going to the school for the first time, whereby here are white teachers and white students, it literally made me feel like I didn't belong, because one, I didn't understand the language. I was in an environment whereby I know nothing. I literally felt like I need to go and hide somewhere. This is not something that I, this is not for me. And whenever I would go back to the rural village, I had a sense of belonging, because in the village, there are no fences. There's no walls that separate homes. But when I went to town, all the houses had big walls around them. There were guard dogs, and there were all of these things that I'd never had seen before. So I always then knew that the life in the city probably wasn't necessarily designed for me. And I had struggled then to adjust into understanding exactly what my placement is here. I would never lie, Ben, and say that we grew up poor. I think we were one of the few families that grew up privileged, because we had seven male figures who all were doing certain things all over. I mean, one of my uncles was a premier. He ended up being the premier of the province. Then he became the minister of sport. Other one had a franchise of Spas, which is a shopping center. Others were rectors at university. So we kind of like grew up, you know, financially, we were okay. But when it came to identity, one, I'm not Xhosa, I'm Bondo, but I grew up around Xhosas. So that already was a struggle, a tribal struggle, whereby our cultural practices are completely different from what Xhosas are doing. So therefore, we were always the one family in the village that didn't really belong. So moving from the school whereby I failed everything, I stayed with this white lady, and then I went to another school. This school now has a policy that no foreign languages allowed to be spoken on the school grounds during school hours. Now, a foreign language is my home language and Xhosa and others. So you can't speak your own language whilst you're at the school premises. You either have to speak English or Afrikaans, because teachers need to understand exactly what you're saying. They need to hear what you're saying, so that if you are threatening, then they need to know. So then I couldn't speak to my friends in English. So we would always speak Xhosa on the playground and so on. And I knew that I had detention on a weekly basis. So it was either detention or would get a hiding. And the hiding was, this is a foreign language. You should not speak this language in this school. People who speak this language don't belong to this school. They belong somewhere else. So then I always knew that, okay, again, this is a borrowed environment. This is an environment whereby I'm just here for a short period of time. At least when I go home, I go into a sanctuary of, you know, speaking to my own peers. So that became I couldn't really see it as a struggle, but because I saw it as an opportunity, maybe they are pushing me to learn something that I wouldn't have learned out of my own. Because now I learned English, I learned Afrikaans that way, even though I didn't like the process, but I had an advantage of having these other languages that I at least knew. And going into high school, again, high school was the same. We had the initiation where you get beaten up. They would only take 5 Black students per intake, because they needed to maintain the numbers. So all the other students needed to be white, and then only 5 per year could be Black. So again, studying in that particular space, higher grade was a luxury, which meant that only the white students could take subjects in higher grades. Black students needed to take standard grade or functional grade, because you guys are not smart enough, you belong in this class. So even how we were seated in the classroom, we found ourselves, you know, being seated on one side of the classroom, whereas the others would be seated on the nicer side. So the teacher would pay more attention to this side versus this side. But again, I mean, we used to challenge those things by, you know, studying together in groups, and the students didn't have a problem mixing with us. And we learned with our peers, and we could compete academically with them. And eventually we were then integrated, and then we would be sitting right next to each other in the classroom, because the argument that we were dumb fell through when our results showed the alternative. So then it was a matter of, every obstacle. I mean, your hair, Ben, I love your hair. That was not allowed because in our culture, cutting your hair bald, it's a complete norm. Whenever you have a bereavement in the family, we cut our hair bald. So we've got instances where, and I mean, I need to cut my hair. This is too long for me. But at high school, I was never allowed. It had to be, I think it's number four in terms of those clipper blades. So you couldn't cut it shorter. So Steve's hair, it would be perfect. So my hair needed to be similar height as Steve's, similar length. So that on its own meant that culturally we were also, you know, discriminated against, because that which was a norm to us, we were told that you couldn't. If you do it, you get punished. So Saturdays were Saturday detention. So you spend your whole Saturday taking out tables and then taking sandpaper and you're just cleaning up the tabletops of those tables whilst everyone else is either playing sports or being at home. So those struggles, they taunted me into either becoming the victim of this story or becoming a victor, and understanding that, you know, no one ever said that life would be fair. Life is just going to give you all of these obstacles. And my father always say to me, listen, I've never raised a weakling. You can't be my son and be a weakling. So therefore, at any given opportunity, even if I'm in a fight, I mean, I would get a hiding if I ever come home crying that I was in a fight and I lost. So I would get a hiding and you will take me by the ear, go back and fight. And then he would make sure that, you know, all opportunities, I needed to take the positive side of it instead of playing the victim of it. So so all of those things then created a character within me to be more sympathetic whenever I'm addressing students in a classroom, because now I don't know everyone's background. So I can't discriminate, even when I'm starting off a lesson. I mean, when I was in Norway and I had to talk about dyscalculia as one of the topics, the first thing that I did is I came into the lecture room at the university and I said, "Molweni ninjani, ikabalamu SH ndosuka e," and then everyone's like, "What?" And they're like, "Sorry, we don't understand." And I said, "Exactly my point. Whenever you are coming with a new concept, a mathematical concept to students with such barriers, and you've never really taken the time to understand or to even ask where people come from, this is how students feel. The way that you had felt about how I was speaking Xhosa, that's how students feel when you're trying to talk mathematical terminologies. So how do we overcome those things?" Then it became my thesis then was based on mathematical modeling. How do you build models in order for you to overcome these challenges that you are going to encounter, whether it's a personal challenge, whether it's an academic challenge, or even a professional challenge? So it was that exciting journey for me to, I think that's why I love maths, is whenever there's a challenge, surely there should be a solution. Surely. I think that's what I think of that.
Steve, I know you want to jump in because I've seen you unmuting yourself a couple of times, but I'm just going to jump on really quickly. It makes me laugh. This is it. Like, you were sat on that side that was, you've got to do foundation, you've got to do standard, you're not allowed to do higher. And then just tell everybody on the call, like, what level of mathematics have you got now?
Right now I've got PhD level. So graduated 2019 with my PhD. And that's probably one of the reasons why I've been traveling in and out of the country a lot. That's because I needed to do a comparative analysis study between South African academia and the Scandinavian countries, purely because I heard a lot of good things about what they're doing there. And I wanted to extract whatever is good and try and bring those models into our classrooms this side.
Yeah. So, a PhD in maths. It's almost like, let's stick two fingers up back to that system just to say, this is the proof of it. You are the proof of it, aren't you? Like, yeah.
Life, man. That's life.
Yeah. Unfortunately, so, though, it's not everybody's life, though, because I've never, I think you've made the best of it, but I take my hat off because ultimately I've never had to go through those struggles. My bit was behaviour in school, nothing to do with the colour of my skin and anything else, probably the fact that I just talked a lot, thought I was a class clown, and I was telling somebody earlier, actually, somebody that works alongside me, a colleague, my whole experience in art, loved art, but was just switched off from art. My bad experience in education is nowhere near. It's not comparable. It's nothing to do with anything else. It was just the fact that I was a bit of a naughty and a disruptor. So I spent the whole time in the is it the green room, the bit where they do the photography,
the dark room.
So I had to work in isolation on my own in the dark room for my whole 2 years. Not for 2 years in the dark room. That would be really bad. But yes, every time I went to art. So just on that, I do take my hat off, like I've said, to embracing the structure, that challenge. But also, what I loved about that story, and thinking about the positives of that story, is the system was basically just saying, this is the way it is, we make the rules, you do as you're told, and this is what we're saying, that you are lesser, when clearly it wasn't about that, it's about the colour and people's prejudice. But ultimately, what I loved about the story was that you as a collective group of students decided that actually, regardless of the five versus the rest of the students, they said, no, we're all equal. We're going to try and work together. And they disrupted and changed the system in that school or your experience, which is the bit that I absolutely loved about that story. Because ultimately, absolutely, the only way that we change it, and this is the bit where we talk about the Edge of Future is trying to change the system, because it's not broken, but it's completely incorrect in the UK. We're sitting exams. And does it take an uprising from not just us, but the students to really change the system, to then say, we don't want to sit these exams anymore because we don't think they're any good. Just to touch on that, apologies, but you said you spent time in the Nordics, and I know the Nordics are held up in terms of their education system, or one that is working positively. Mm. Other than the comparison, did you take any learning? Because I know that where you live, where you work and where you live and your hometown and everything else is something you're really passionate about. And the reason you did it is to bring back and bring a gift back to where you then try and improve the education system. What learnings, just how to be better at delivering maths, did you feel you learned from from Norway or those countries that you think that were good? Or actually, did you find that a lot of the system is pretty much the same? It's just a different language.
Yeah. So even though I couldn't implement everything, I mean, I had learned so much. One of the things that I had learned is that there was a less obsession with uniforms, and there was a greater appreciation of, uniqueness and individuality. Because when I had arrived, I asked, how do you guys place your children? How do you know which child goes where? Do you have private schools? Because in South Africa, we've got private schools. So, and I know that the majority of our ministers, and so the people that have got highest salaries, take their kids to private schools. So how do you guys manage that so that there is a fairness? And they said, well, we don't have much private schools here that are ranked. I mean, private schools are mainly, specializing schools, but we don't have private schools. So that means that it becomes difficult for one to justify why this particular school. So it becomes easy for students to go to a nearby school instead of, that is the best school, you must go there. So how they are utilizing their resources in terms of teacher professional development and the resourcing of schools is not, maybe some schools receive all of the funding and others receive absolutely nothing. I think there is a fair model that they are utilizing in Norway. So as I had observed all of these things, I thought to myself, yeah, this we can't do immediately in South Africa. I mean, even I went to some of their jails looking at how are they treating their prisoners, and they wouldn't call them prisoners. They would call them, more correctional facilities, because they were there to correct a behavior. And because they're correcting a behavior, they would bring in professional teachers to come and continue the learning journey, because these people still need to be assimilated into the communities. So they can't be treated as if, they're scum of the earth. Whereas in South Africa, I mean, that is not something that is highly appreciated. Once you're in jail, you're the worst of the worst. Therefore, whatever happens to you happens to you. So when it came to one thing that I also saw is that some of the schools, they would have maybe a grade go to the fields and they would just stay outside for a whole day because this Wednesday, it's a sunny day. So then the kids would be ushered to a park and they'll spend time playing with each other in the park with the supervision of the teachers. And I'm like, why do you take kids? I mean, don't you lose academic time? They're like, no. A happy child is a child who's willing to learn. Therefore, what we are doing here is we are creating a healthy, happy learning environment. So learning doesn't always have to take place inside the classroom. When we're taking these kids out to the play area, it's not that they are doing nothing. They are playing. It's a social skill that they are learning. They are learning to, so how do you negotiate whenever there's one swing? How do you share one resource? How do you function as a collective? And how do you make sure that you're supporting one when one falls off a swing or whatever happens? Those were the lessons that I'm like, I think we might have been overestimating, you know, ourselves. And I loved their social aspect to a point where when I got back into South Africa, one of the things that I would do, which was not necessarily the most popular, was on a weekly basis, on a Friday, I would take my kids out outside, where they were gonna play netball, we're gonna play soccer, it would be boys versus girls, and then we'd have a fat laugh because now the girls would win the netball, the boys would win the soccer, and then we'll say, okay, fine, now what are we learning? And then we'll talk about strengths and weaknesses. And so then we'll start swapping roles now. So we try and do as many fun things purely because the model of not putting too much pressure, academic pressure on students, focusing on grades, focusing on, you know, this needs to be completed by this day. You need to sit in your own table. How do you collaborate when every child is not allowed to speak to the next one? So that culture then, when I brought it back to some of my schools, it was more about, no, but this is not how we do education. This is not on. And I'm like, yeah, but it works somewhere else. I took a couple of videos and I showed them, like, look at how happy these kids are. Look at where they are ranking in the world. And they're not doing anything fancy. They don't have a better curriculum than we do. They have a similar curriculum. It's just that the kids are happier and they are treated as human beings and not as objects that are going to be carried into an industrial revolution whereby all they need to do is follow instructions. Let them be treated as human beings so that they can function as human beings.
Yeah, and just on that point, I think this is my struggle with exams as the only way to test a student's aptitude and preparedness and everything else that I think is wrong. It's because, like you've just said, when students are working in isolation, they don't get to share, they don't get to collaborate. They might have fun. Some people do enjoy exams, but if you ask the majority, I think it's a stressful and anxious time, especially the conditions we put them into. Move this forward into, let's call it, the real world. When did we last get issued or been given a task or saying, can you solve this problem, where you couldn't explore it and try and find out on the internet, but you couldn't ask a friend or a colleague? And you just worked in isolation and you had to sit there until that problem appeared to you. And you then were limited by 3 hours. And if you didn't do it, you were seen as a failure.
Exactly.
Why do we still think that that is the best way to test a student's knowledge in this real world that has been happening for well beyond probably when I went to school? So I see that actually the education system for me probably failed me because I didn't want to work in that way. Didn't like exams and didn't want to work in isolation. I like to talk. I like to collaborate. I like to waffle, as everybody knows on the podcast now. But ultimately, I like to share my ideas and work in collaboration with others as a collective. I think it's Professor Linda Hill from Harvard, and she talks about collective genius and all these things. It picks our approach of, you know, those people who think that they design the movie, produce the movie, draw the movie, do everything else, and then get it out to the cinema. That's not one person that's done a Pixar movie. That's a collective element. We talked about, and if anybody's read the book, I'll put it in the show. Yeah. It's a fantastic podcast, TEDx talk and everything else. That's really what education is and learning is and the real world is. Yeah. And what you described. Yeah, sorry, go on.
Yeah, can I just share one thing? I think maybe Ben might want to segue into this at a later stage. Yeah. But I think the way that maybe sometimes we approach education is maybe the wrong way. We don't start with what is it that we're trying to do with education. We are first putting what we want to teach without knowing exactly how are these skills ever going to be utilized by any of these students that we are teaching. So in one of my sit-down sessions with Ben, I was talking about the importance of identity, whether it's your own identity or it's the identity of your purpose. And so I said to you, I'm Mbondo, deliberately, because I speak Xhosa most of the time. And when I rekindled with the kingdom last year, I just came back from Rwanda, and I was told that I was summoned by the queen. So I got back to the kingdom, and she's like, yeah, you do know that you're Mbondo. And I'm like, yeah, I'm Mbondo. But she asked me, what does Mbondo mean to you? So I'm like, Mbondo is my clan. I mean, that's where I belong. She's like, who is Mbondo? What is Mbondo? And then I was stuck. And then they pulled the family tree at which they, now I need to track exactly where do I belong into this family lineage of Mbondos. And when I was connected to the word Mbondo, knowing exactly my placement, then they asked me another question. What is your purpose in this whole Mbondo family tree? What value do you add by your own existence into this family tree? As highly educated as I am, that question, when it was asked to me, I couldn't answer, because I realized that I did education in isolation for a singular purpose, which was myself. Now, how do I translate having a PhD in mathematics to what it is that I'm doing with that PhD for communities that actually need a person who will say, because ideally, I would like to even propose that maybe a person who's educated must be a person who is able to translate lessons learned in a classroom to resolving real world problems. I would like to say that you need to only call yourself educated if you are able to take the lessons and you are able to do something about those lessons. Because if you can't, what then was the purpose of you sitting in a classroom? Because even the jobs that we go into, it's not because of the memory of X plus X is 2X. It's purely because some of these portfolios, they only want you to follow instructions and not necessarily to think of innovative ways of solving problems. And that has been my perspective around my contribution in going back then, is to emancipate the youth in not thinking that the way that education is done is probably the best way. My question is always, so where you stay now, what problems do you see? What problems have you identified? What do you like, or what don't you like about where you stay? And then let us build a curriculum based on what is there, what do we want to fix? And the ability then for me then to add that value as a Mbondo is to say, my mathematics is only relevant if I can translate it from the certificate to what I am able to assist the community in developing, in order for students to own themselves, own their own, because now we've got a lot of migration. Students are leaving one province to another because this is the promised land. But if they knew who they were and they had a pride in who they are, they're not going to run away from problems that they are facing, but they will have a skill of resolving that, fixing that, so that we're able to have better communities.
Yeah, and I absolutely want to jump all over this, because that phrase education, obviously people have probably heard me talk about this on a podcast before, and if not, other people have said it probably better than me as well. The word education comes from the Latin phrase educare, which means to bring out or to draw out. That's what's within, to lead out from within the person. So it's almost this idea that as educators, our job is not to put things in, it's to draw things out. And I love that as a concept. And from what you're talking about there, is that as your heritage, your culture is what is in you, you have no choice about that in terms of where you but you have a choice of what you do with that. But then there's a passion that comes with it that is only you, things that you're interested in, and then you have the choice there, and then you draw that out, and education and educators, their responsibilities help bring that and bring that to life. And so the best educators that we talk about, the people that you remember from school, the people that really get this, don't just say, here is Pythagoras' theorem. We had this conversation, didn't we? Here's Pythagoras' theorem, but this is what it means in context. This is the reason why we learn this. This is the reason why we have to understand this and why it might be relevant in your situation. And if you don't bring that kind of real world connection, which is what you're talking about there, then the whole point of the system is broken. It's like I've been banging on about recently all over social media and in my newsletter stuff, like this idea that education has to have purpose. It's like, unless there's a reason why we're doing it, there is no need, just because somebody has said it 20 years ago, 5 years ago, 50 years ago, that it needs to be in a curriculum for students. It doesn't necessarily need to be. And actually, we probably won't go to that today. That might be another conversation if we speak to Mr. Shelton at some point. Like, the people that decided what was in the curriculum were of a certain people group, of a certain mindset, of a certain gender generally. And so they determined that's what needs to be delivered. Anyway, I'll get off that soapbox. But I love that. I love what you're saying. I love how you are were summoned by the Queen. And people who have made a connection realize who the Queen is. But the principle behind that is that you are connected to your land, to your people, connected to making a difference where you are. And then for the young people there, instilling in them what is already in them, or just bringing out what is in them. And one of the things I said I would mention is the Bridge project that I know you're working on and the team are working on over there. Just as a little bit of a sideline, tell us a little bit about what's happening over there in the Eastern Cape.
Yeah, so we're busy building a bridge that connects both the Eastern Cape and KwaZulu-Natal, which is the two provinces adjacent to each other. And the bridge is being currently built on my portion of land. I've got some land in the Eastern Cape. So this bridge now is going to be connecting the two provinces. So historically, what we used to ask is, if you are Xhosa or you are Mbondo, how do we know that you are Xhosa or Mbondo? So there would be a rhyme that you need to know and you need to say. So I don't know if Steve is ready for this, but you know, in order for us to identify exactly who you are, you would need to say this. Qondile uqalene nekwaqonda lamaqhaqo basemqolo qhega ngiqale ngomgqibelo xabendile qongo umqomo nabalekela kulo qeqe utata kaqeqe qhega ngiqona ngibale qonga umqomo liqhubula ngequthe umqondo umqomo ngiqhebile. So now that is a an identifier from our side that tends to place you into a particular region, so we know exactly who you are. Now the bridge is going to be connecting the Mpondo tribe with the Zulus, so that now one of the things is that we can't marry if you don't belong to a monarchy. So the bridge then is a connection between these two worlds, so that the royal families then can intermarry. So I need to marry either lady from KZ, KwaZulu-Natal, or Eswatini in order for us to continue with that monarchy. So I officiate the bridge. I've been there a couple of times, and one of the questions that I asked whilst they were busy selecting people who are going to be building the bridge is, how are you selecting the people? And then I looked at the contracts and they said, well, they are going to be employing locals to be building the bridge. But then one of the clauses in that contract was that they need to be skilled. So the majority of the chiefs that signed everything off, and then I looked at them like, can you explain what the word skilled means? Because I just need to explain to my people what is the expectation. And said, no, but you need to be skilled enough to build a bridge. And I'm like, okay, what evidence do they need to provide in order for them to successfully land this opportunity? And he said, yeah, but you need to have some paperwork. And I'm like, yeah, people got excited at the prospects of working at this bridge, but none of them know that they are not even qualified. So they're excited about the prospect you've created, and you've raised expectations that there's going to be work, and you got this job because people signed off being excited that, you know, people are going to get employment. And I just needed to just read the document and just ask some questions. I mean, because I'm like, I'm dumb, I'm very slow. I just need to ask. When I see an English word, I always go back into the time where I didn't even know English. I just, can you please define this word? What does this word mean? What does it mean? And then through that, we've had to overhaul the whole contract so that more people from the community could be integrated into the building project. It's going to be named after my late uncle, the one who was the Minister of Sport. So it's going to be finished next year in April. So I need to go back home and make sure that, you know, everything goes according to plan. So I'm always interacting with the Minister of Transport and the others, you know, just to keep update in terms of where we at with the project. And,
this is not just any old bridge though, for anybody who is this is a big bridge, right?
Yeah, it's one of the biggest bridges in Africa. It's Msikaba Bridge. So you can just type it out, Msikaba Bridge. So it's one of the biggest bridges that covers a gorge. So there's a gorge between the Eastern Cape and KZN. So that is probably one of the longest bridges that we're going to have here in Africa. The bridge is connecting to Lusikisiki and all the waterfalls that we have. So we've got some of these wonderful waterfalls, which I'm advocating for people to just come, because we're going to start building some holiday resorts where Ben is going to come and stay. I've got a couple of wonderful rendezvous there for you, Ben. So when you and your family come through to South Africa again, you will have an experience of being in Mpondo land, staying facing the ocean, seeing how our cattle, because we don't have kraals for cattle, kettles roam around free because we don't have any crime, no stock theft, none of those things. And all we want is we want to make sure that, you know, we are creating that tourist vibe. You know, we're going to be doing a lot of wonderful things on that space.
Yeah, love it. I've just Googled it. It's 580 meters long, and at the height is 192 meters. So it's a giant thing. But yeah, I'm looking forward to coming over in May again. I'm going to be over in May. Hopefully, get over to the Eastern Cape. In fact, no, hopeful. I will be coming over to the Eastern Cape while I'm there.
So that's going to
be great fun. So we always finish our podcast because we're really great for your time. I reckon we could talk for as Steve would say, all night. We could have, there's loads of things we could go into. We usually finish with some like quick fire questions now. Quick fire questions, I say to you.
So
here we go. So this is the first one. What do you think is the biggest threat to the future of education? What would you say is the biggest threat?
Rigidity, tradition, and fear.
Love it.
Quick enough?
Yeah, quick enough.
Well, good. What do you think the main skill students will be in 2040?
Excuse me?
The biggest skill, so the main skill that we need to provide students with in 2040?
Soft skills. Empathy, collaboration. I think those are the critical skills.
Yeah, okay. For sure. What do you think the next big trend in EdTech will be?
Project-based teaching and learning in our context. I don't know about other countries because we talk about it, but we never do it. So that blended flipped classroom, that to me would become the next big thing.
I'll take the last one. Education in 50 years, what is your vision for what education should be?
Sure. Customized education per community based on their needs. Complete decentralization. Giving power back to the people.
Yes. Do you know, Steve's laughing. If anybody who's listened to this knows what we've talked about for the last, 3-4 years, we've talked about the problems of centralization. We've had so many people that have talked about, like, online virtual schools, the people that are trying to do it differently, where homeschooling and almost that concept of decentralization. And interestingly, I genuinely believe that, I'm with you, I think that has to be the future, away from a formalized, centralized, bureaucratized, bastardized curriculum.
Doesn't work.
We need to, we've seen it, haven't we? So, mate, it's we've had an hour and 5 minutes. This could have been definitely flip that and 5 hours in 1 minute. It's been brilliant. Where can people find you? Where's the best place to find you, SA2, online, on social?
Only on LinkedIn. I don't do social stuff. No. I'll explain it to you in the next podcast, but I'm only on LinkedIn, SA2 Stofile.
Yeah, perfect. Well, thank you so much for joining us this evening, SA2. It has been an absolute honor and a pleasure, and we'll look forward to part number two.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Ben and Steve. Keep well.